Hello, my name's James and I'm an addict.
Hi, James.
In 1985 at the European Service Conference, I was asked to do a talk at Chennai, and it was the first time I used a microphone, and I did it and I had a panic attack. It was absolutely horrific. So what I've done, I'll just let you know, I've made a few notes because I'm frightened of freezing up. And I've been sitting with anxiety all day because I've got this feeling like I'm doing an exam, you know? And people are going to say, you fucking failed, you know? Or whatever. What a load of bollocks. Or all that stuff. The difference today is I didn't use on it. And the other thing I didn't do, I didn't smoke cigarettes on it because I gave up smoking 8.5 years ago. And I didn't drink coffee on it, which I would have done at one time because it felt like when I was in the early 90s, I went to do further education as an adult. And that was the sort of feeling I had when I was doing essays or had to give some kind of thing on the workshops. But anyway, I just wanted to say that because, you know, what I learned early on was to externalise this stuff, to take the power out of it. Now, I didn't know any of that 40-odd years ago or 50 years ago, you know. I'm 56. I'm a bit of an old fogey. And it's funny, this building here, I remember staying in this building 30-odd years ago. This used to be a kind of a doss house upstairs where the post office is. And I remember on one of those series of rock bottoms ending up spending about a week in this absolutely dreadful place. Most of the people living there were using and whatever, you know, alcoholics. And I really take this illness seriously, you know. I just want to share something. My guy called Richard S., he was... did the Clean Times magazine, and he also did the Where to Find, and he died at the end of November of this disease, and he relapsed after 7 years. He relapsed in 1997, and he was my stepdaughter's dad. And 6 weeks after that, his wife died as well of this disease. Two people, you know. One was 49 years old and one was 47. And I'm sort of engaged with my wife and stepdaughter in picking up the pieces, and there's a lot of, I'm not going to go into it, but there's a lot of fallout in all sorts of ways. An interesting thing happened, you know, and this is just, I'm going to talk briefly just about what this program is really about. And anyway, I had to go with my stepdaughter to see the family, who are all in denial about this disease, and it was a really heavy situation without going into detail. And I came back, and her mum took her off to Liverpool. She's at university there. And I went upstairs and I went into the bedroom, and there was a note on the bed. And the note said, "Dear James, thank you very much for all the help and support you've given me over the last 3 weeks. I couldn't have done it without you. Love, Anna." And it really touched me, you know. And I felt vulnerable. But I didn't go into, "I'm just a wanker," you know. I was actually able to sort of feel that warmth, which was better than any heroin or cocaine I ever used, you know. And that's just what I want to say. And that, you know, that says a lot of things. It says two things. Is one, I'm glad she did it do it to my face, because I'm 56, but I'm 17 going on 56. And she's 20 going on 20. And she's got a difficulty dealing with her feelings as I have with mine. So it would have been a bit awkward doing it face to face, but it was okay, you know. We've got that kind of a relationship, but it's a great relationship, you know, and I really love her. She's a fantastic kid, you know, and I'm very proud of her. And my disease started long before I ever picked up chemicals or alcohol. I normally, on an ordinary chair, I don't talk about this very much because there isn't really time, but there's a little bit more time tonight. And I was into ritual behaviour. Some people would call it OCD today, but I call it the illness of addiction, you know. There's all these fancy names put to it. And what I used to do was I had various rituals I used to do to make myself feel safe. And also, I grew up in a family where there was no obvious alcoholism, not in the immediate family, but there was lots of other shit going on. And I had abuse in all senses of the word, including sexual, not by a family member, immediate family member. And when I was 12 years old, it manifested in, I got very ill. I had shingles, congestion of the lungs and pleurisy altogether. And I believe that was a manifestation of of what was happening. And I was given by my father's alcoholic doctor friend, Librium. I could identify with what you were saying. And that was the first drug that I ever really had, and that made me feel good, you know? I like that. Don't remember too much about it, but I felt there was something wrong. And I couldn't talk about the stuff at that time. There was nobody to talk about it. It didn't even occur to me to talk about it, you know? And the next drug I picked up, and it is a drug, is alcohol, you know? You know, I think people forget that sometimes. It's alcohol is another drug, you know? And what I love about this fellowship is it talks about the disease of addiction. It doesn't talk about specific drugs. It's talking about the disease of addiction. And I picked up alcohol, and alcohol made me feel whole, made me feel complete. And I felt okay, and all that anxiety and all that sort of, like I'm feeling today, all was going away, you know. I could talk to girls and have a good time, you know. In those days it was Pils Lager. Some of you, the older ones here, might remember it, you know. Pils Lager and, I don't remember, some kind of beer. 2 pints and I was anybody's, you know. And then it was cannabis and pills. There was a pill in those days called Mandrax. Randy Mandy's. My whole school thing started to fall away. My parents paid for me, and I was never allowed to forget it until I was 14, and I won a scholarship. And I got this scholarship, and I remember going to England and staying with my aunt and uncle, and just obsessed all summer with the results of the exams, because in those days you did a thing 2 years before GCSE called Junior Certificate of Education. Nobody here remembers that. And this exam, I passed it and I got a scholarship. And I really thought, they've made a mistake, you know, somebody else's paper. I worked it out, there was no way I could have passed. And I passed quite well. So there was a whole self-worth issue at that time. I actually was doing better than I thought I was. But it would go from one extreme to another. So I started to feel badly at school, you know. I didn't understand what was going on. I had a lot of anger and a lot of fucking violent fantasy that I couldn't talk about. And all the ritualistic stuff was still there. I'd have to check my eyes before I went to bed, because if I didn't, I was going to go blind and something was going to kill me in my sleep and so on. And I was addicted to food, you know. I would eat 2/3 of a loaf before I went to school to kill the feelings. And the interesting thing was, I didn't know what I was doing then, because my daughter, my older daughter, Hannah, who, when her mother was in recovery, relapsed and died as well, you know. My older daughter relapsed at 7 years. And she said, she was quite aware, I used to take her to NA meetings, and she said to me, "Dad, why did you use?" And I said, "Because I was in pain." And she said, "But you didn't know that then." And of course I didn't. This is all in retrospect. And I used because I wanted to feel part of something. You know, I felt, you know, at that time, this is the late 60s, there's a whole alternative culture going on, you know. There was this sort of flower power thing, and, you know, I wanted to be a part of that. And it was all, it seemed terribly exciting, and, you know, there was the music and everything. And I came to London, and I immediately got involved with heroin. And there was an old Canadian junkie who used to say, "If God made anything better, he kept it for himself." And that's what I thought, you know. This is it, you know. I feel complete. I feel whole. And I did. I felt whole for a while, you know. And I remember I was further up the street there, and I went to see a film, I think it was 1970, of Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And I felt really uncomfortable in the film, you know. And I thought, what's wrong with me? You know, I'm shivering and I'm sort of flu-y symptoms. And just by coincidence, I had a shot of junk and the symptoms were gone. Then I noticed this a few days later. I didn't even know I was addicted, you know. I didn't really know. You have to work hard at it, you know. Or I had to work hard at it. And anyway, you know, I went on from 1970 to 1984, and they were terrible years, really. I went to see my chiropractor the other day, and she knows I'm a recovering addict, and she said to me, "What is it like to rock bottom?" And I thought, why do I explain this? And I thought of the bit in the book, I'm sick of tired of being sick and tired, you know. And that was really it. You know, sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I tried all sorts of things. You know, I remember I went to prison for a long time in the early 70s. And my father paid for me to go and see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said, you're emotionally immature, which I knew. And he said, you'll grow out of it, which reinforced my denial. You know, I thought, well, yeah, at some point I'll stop when I'm older. And the other psychiatrist, which was a prison psychiatrist, said, you're a psychopath with sociopathic tendencies, you know. And that's the one the judge listened to. And that was probably true. I mean, again, it's one of these sort of labels that we get given, you know, over the years. And of course I took that, I internalised that one, you know, that was, yeah, that's me. And, you know, the rock bottoms, you know, this thing about rock bottoms, for me it was just a series of rock bottoms. You know, I'd pull myself up and I'd fall down again. I spent half my adult life in prison, and I can seriously say it saved my life. You know, on the last occasion, my higher power pulled the plug on me in 1984. I went to prison for the umpteenth time. And when I was in prison, you know, again, it gave me time to think. I was in with somebody else, and my thoughts were there was a special unit for treatment of addiction. Well, it wasn't treatment for addiction. It was a unit for addicts, alcoholics, and sex offenders and in Worm and Scruggs. And I thought the only reason I went there, because we were getting visits, and we were getting some gear in on visits. And I thought, well, I don't want to go to the Isle of Wight, because that's going to make it awkward to get the visits. I knew this unit, you could play table tennis all day, you weren't locked up, and the officers called you by your first name, and I thought, this sounds ideal. So on the 25th of August 1984, I'm in Wormwood Scrubs, having a spliff. 10 minutes later, prison officer walked in, he said, pack your bags, tomorrow morning you're going to Wormwood Scrubs. Now at that point, I didn't know that would be the last time I used. And that was the 25th of August, 1984. I had really no thoughts about it. You know, I went to the Scrubs and I was in a cell. And there was a guy, I like to call him, it's not my term, he was the first Eskimo I came across. This guy never got clean, but he 12-stepped me. And he was the secretary of the NA meeting in prison. And his name was Louis. And he said to me, here's the recovery text. And I read it, and I didn't identify with any of it. And I people-pleased him and said I'd go to the meeting, basically get him off my case. And that was why I went. They had a meeting in there on a Wednesday night. Went to the meeting. And the first guy I ever saw was somebody I'd used with from years before, a guy called John V, who was one of the founder members of NA. He's dead now, sadly. And he was an absolute lunatic. But he was very sane-looking, you know, and he was clean. And I knew he was clean. I wasn't one of those addicts that thought, nah, they're all using. I knew he was clean. You know, I looked at it, I could tell by his eyes, his demeanour. And I was really impressed. But the second thing that impressed me, I can't tell you much, I went to the meeting every week for 6 months, was this guy had lost his son to the disease of addiction. When he was 18 months clean, his son had died of the disease of addiction and he hadn't used. And I thought that was amazing. More than amazing. I just couldn't imagine how you could go through something like that and not pick up. Now, I went to the meeting every week, and I was quite cynical about NA, to be honest with you. I looked at the 12 steps. Now, I had grown up in a family. Two members of my family were head of the church. So, God didn't go down too well, you know. My God was a God of eternal damnation. And, you know, I had prayed. You know, I remember praying once. It's an ironic story. I went to Amsterdam on the 17th of January 1977 to score 6 cents of heroin. And I went with somebody who's actually in the fellowship today. And driving back, he was absolutely off his head. And I said to him, man, you'd not think it'd be an idea if I drove? Because the car's gone all over the road. And this God in my head saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you're going to die, you know? You know, you're really doing something bad here, you know? And he said, you can't, we're not insured. You're not insured. I'm not sure to drive yet. So I've got the window open, and I prayed, and I said, please God, let me get back to Ostend, and I'll never go to Holland again. I never did. I never went back to Holland again. The second time I remember praying seriously was to try and get a hit. Covered in blood on the kitchen floor, please God, get me a hit. But I didn't say I'd never use again. The third time I remember quite well was in prison. It's kind of weird stuff. I was in a cell with a guy, and we made this deal with God that if we read the whole of the Bible, the whole Old Testament, that we would get parole. But we never got through it. But we did get parole, which is quite ironic as well. But this God thing was very difficult for me, you know, and there was a member came in and he said to me, well, I said to him, you know, I don't really like this God thing too much. And he said, well, look, how about G-O-D, good orderly direction? And I thought, wow, that sounds good. That really sat well with me because my life was so chaotic. You know, this disease is something else. You know, I wear 9.5 shoes, and I was walking around at 29 years old with 12.5 carpet slippers. My feet were blown up. My hands were black, like boxers' hands. I was in a terrible mess. My liver was packing up, you know. I remember getting that sort of repeating rotten egg taste, and that's not good when that starts to happen, you know. Shortly before I stopped using, my tolerance started to go, which is not good either. And, you know, the other reason I stopped using, I think, or I wanted to stop, was I couldn't get a hit anymore, and I thought, well, I don't want to drink methadone. I thought, that's boring. And the real reason, was I lost custody of my daughter. I've got a 28-year-old daughter, and I lost custody. And I used that. I used for the last 2 years. You know, the other thing about God was one of the other things that the positives of the God of eternal damnation is this, is that it says in the Bible, he that taketh his own life shall be condemned to eternal damnation. I can't commit suicide. At least I can't take responsibility. I was hoping it might happen, you know. If I have enough gear, it'll happen. But I'm not taking responsibility for it. And I never did. I never attempted suicide. But paradoxically, I was killing myself on a daily basis. So, yeah. So, I don't know. You know, I kept coming back to meetings. And I remember, and stuff was going in, you know, internalizing these very important things, these slogans, you know, these things. Because, you know, the thing about it is, a lot of this stuff sounds obvious, like, it's the first one that does the damage. That didn't occur to me. I mean, a lot of things didn't occur to me. I had a suitcase full of chemist gear under the bed, and there was that song, The Stranglers, Golden Brown. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know that was heroin. Didn't know brown sugar was heroin, the Stones. None of this stuff, for some reason, did I connect with. And a lot of the stuff in NA, it wasn't obvious initially. In saying that, in 1982, I went to Ireland, and I was abstinent for a period of 3 months without this program, living with my mum and dad. And that was absolute hell, you know. And I remember being really angry, not knowing what was going on with me. And I remember my mum saying to me, you've got a chip on your shoulder. I said, yeah, we knew. You know, I was just completely, you know, I had to use. You know, I used. There was no option to kill the feelings. So I came out of prison. The interesting thing was, I remember the first morning I came out with somebody else, and we were going to live in this parole hostel, and he bought 2 cans of special brew, and I find myself saying to him, that's not social drinking. And I didn't know where I knew that from, but obviously the program had gone in. And the interesting thing was, I had an argument with my wife about 4 or 5 months ago. We had an illness in recovery convention, and it was sort of slogan to listen and learn. And my wife and I were talking about this, and she took exception to the idea of learning. And I said, well, I think it is about learning, you know. And I continuously learn because it's about learning. You know, I knew nothing, and I came here to learn from other people. And I learned that You know, I learned in those meetings, those early meetings, you know, something that went in. Because I saw the first step primarily at that time about drugs. I didn't understand the concept of addiction. You know, I saw it as, and I didn't really understand the idea of alcohol. Although I stayed clean, I actually had in my mind, I'll give it a year. I came out of prison, I was 7 months clean, I'll give it to a year clean and see what happens. I came out of prison and I was living in this parole release scheme, and I remember walking down the road and with these two other guys, and they weren't going to the meeting, and they got a spliff, and he said, "Do you want a spliff?" And I said, "No, I'm going to an NA meeting." And he said, "But they won't know." And I said, "But I'll know." And I don't know where that came from, and I think that was my higher self. And so I'm going to the meeting. The first meeting I ever went to, I was completely overwhelmed. I don't know. The guy was wearing a dinner suit. And I thought, that's how they do it out of prison. They wear dinner suits. You know? I think it was actually his birthday and he was going out for dinner. Black and white dinner suit. And in the meeting, and this is where I think it's really important, you know, about saving the last 10 minutes for newcomers, because I'm sitting there. And the secretary said, saving the last 10 minutes for newcomers. And normally everybody's coming in, but nobody did. And I felt like everybody was looking at me. And they probably were. And I found myself these words coming out. And, you know, I really got the support I needed. And I'm really, really grateful for those people who give me the time. And that's what kept me coming back. And at the end of the meeting, I was very fortunate in seeing somebody there who I'd used with, the long distance past. He kind of read my mind. He said, because I'm still in that place of, you know, I don't know if this is right for me. You know, NA, this is the early days of NA, it was sort of twin sets and pearls, you know. It was kind of slightly different to it is today. It's a bit more, NA's grown up a lot, and it's changed a lot, for the better, I think. And those days I kind of felt a bit different. And I was, part of me was looking for the differences and not the similarities. But I kept coming back, and that's what people kept saying. Just keep coming back. And that's what I did. And I was really, really frightened, absolutely terrified. I used to go to a meeting every night. And I remember once, after about 6 months, I decided not to go to a meeting. And I thought, shit, I went to the cinema instead. And I didn't use, you know. That was great. And over a period of time, I started to realise I had a choice. The works wasn't going to jump into my arm. It wasn't going to happen like that. It was going to be a conscious decision. And the programme had given me enough space to make that conscious decision if I wanted to. I could do that if I wanted to. And I chose not to. And, you know, I got myself a sponsor. I didn't really know why I needed a sponsor. I didn't understand it. I used to say to people, what's all this feelings business about? I didn't understand it. I heard people in the meetings talk about guilt and shame and fear, and I heard people crying in the meetings. I saw them crying and I thought, why are they crying? Because I couldn't allow myself to go there, you know? I remember in prison, people who were healthier than me were crying because they're homesick. And I remember saying to one guy, well, you shouldn't have fucking done it then. You wouldn't be in here. That's my answer. You know, you don't fucking cry. And I remember in prison, I remember that thing that actually... Recovery started before NA even, was when I went into the special unit. Prison officer, his name was Dick Gladdy, came up to me and he said to me, what's your name? I said, Smith B156478. He said, what's your first name? I'm thinking, what? I said, James. And he said, I'm Dick, and shook my hand. And I thought, fuck this. It was really weird. But this was the first time I felt I was treated like a human being. And that was very important. You know, it was very, very important. That was the start of the healing process. You know, because I always say to people, you know, there's four things I heard in the early meetings, or one of my early sponsors said to me, there are four non-negotiable needs. The need to feel loved, the need to feel accepted, the need to feel we're not alone, and the need to feel understood. And growing up, I got none of those, and I started to get those needs met in NA. And so I got this sponsor. My first sponsor was great. He was the first guy I met, John V. And He told me lots of things. He said, recovery is like a plate, stay too near the edge, you'll fall off. And I never forgot that. That went in. I got myself involved. I was very lucky to meet somebody at the fifth meeting I ever went to. Was a guy who tried 12-stepping me in 1978, and he was in another fellowship. And I said, he's telling me, look, you know, at that stage he was a couple of years sober in AA, and he said, look, you know, why don't you? I said, yeah, later, I'm busy. Anyway, he saw me at this meeting, and he got hold of me, and he swagged me off to H&I, and we went to the H&I committee, and then he swagged me down to the Bexley Hospital, and he said, you can make your steps 8 and 9 amends to society, and you can take the meeting there. And he took me along to the Bethlehem Royal Hospital. He said, you can do the meeting here as well. And I did the meeting there for the next 3 years in each place. You know. And, you know, eventually I was in the H&I committee, and I had about 8 sponsees, and had loads going on. This is the whole thing. Program for me is about balance, and I didn't have that. The other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, ritual in recovery, because what happened when I put down the drugs, the ritual started again, and I had something like 15 to 20 of these. That's it just for today, the NA one, but I had different ones, all different programs, and all different books, and it would take me 2.5 hours to get out of the house in the morning. You know, I would have to get up at about 5 o'clock to go to work for 8. I'd have to read all these, because if I didn't read them, something fucking terrible was going to happen. You know? And I couldn't talk about this stuff. I found it really difficult to talk about, because I thought people are going to think, you know, you need to be sectioned somewhere, you know. And it didn't seem to be other people talking about it. So I got some external help. And that was good. And through working the program, this stuff went away. You know, this stuff went away. I can walk over cracks in the road today. You know, it's not a big deal. I can walk under ladders. I just read the one book today, which is just the NA just for today. I occasionally read other ones, you know. But I don't have to read them if I don't want to. Nothing terrible is going to happen. But that was about feeling safe, you know. I had to do that stuff to feel safe. Because the interesting thing was about being in prison, I was actually quite relieved. You know, I'd go to prison, I was relieved. Because I could hand my will and my life over to that institution. You know, I was one of those people, I could go to prison and not use. I spent 2.5 years locked up somewhere without using. It was when I came out, it would all start again. The addiction would all start over again. And you know, and this was the thing, you know, I had a slight issue with this because I couldn't quite understand why I was able to do this. And I had a very good sponsor who sort of explained some of this stuff to me, this need for structure and ritual. And I did a written first step, which was very helpful, and that completely blew it away from me, you know. The denial fell away, and I realised I was powerless over everything. Today, I'm addicted to other things. Anxiety, certainty, adrenaline, anger. Anger's my main addiction. When I cleaned up, all the other things started to surface. Workaholism, sex, food, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for years. For me, this is a very slow process. It has been for me, you know. There's no quick fixes in this program. I've heard people talk about, you know, going through the steps in a year, it's bullshit as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't work like that, you know. The distance from here to here is a lifetime, you know. And I'm a work in progress, you know, and will be. Continue to will be. When I was 10 years clean, I got the obsession to use back again. I didn't know whether I was going to talk about this tonight, but I was involved in a relationship with somebody who was inappropriate. And I was also involved in a relationship with somebody else who was married, which was inappropriate. And I wanted to use. And I was that far away from it. And you know, it got into, I was with a friend the other night, and he was in a weird space, and he was talking about feeling of futility. And I thought, yeah, that's how I felt, completely futile. And I kept thinking all the reasons why I shouldn't use. My daughter, fuck her, NA, fuck them, fuck everybody. And I was really frightened, and I had 2,000 quid in my pocket, and I thought, I'll go and buy an ounce of heroin and an ounce of cocaine. That'll be it. And I rang up somebody who had been a constant relapser, and she said to me, "How about your higher power?" I said, "He's in Australia." And she said, "God will give you the strength if you ask for it." And I thought, okay. And I went home, and I was on my knees, and I prayed, and I fell asleep on top of the bed. And I remember waking up at 3 a.m, freezing cold, and crawling into bed. And I got up in the morning, and it was blue skies, and I remember driving up the Edgware Road and seeing the army horses come across the road up there. And just thinking, it's great to be alive. And the obsession was gone. Now, I had to make some changes there. You know, people say it gets better. That's a half-truth. It doesn't get better. If you're behaving in certain ways, it doesn't get better. I had to change my behaviour because as far as I'm concerned, it's about two things. It's about doing either what you're doing or what you're not doing. And if it's something you're not doing, it's called procrastination. You better fucking do it. And if it's something you're doing, you have to stop doing it. It's as simple as that. And I had to change my behaviour, and I've consistently got to change it. You know, at the end of meetings, when people say the Serenity Prayer, I always say it works if you let it. And I consistently say that because if I let this program work, it will work. You know, and I'm my own biggest enemy, you know. And I've got this resistance in me to this day. I rebel and I fight and I've struggled, and it's a constant surrender. And the illness doesn't go away. I'll tell you why. Last night I had a using dream. And in the dream, it's a hotel room. I can't remember what the number is, and the methadone's in this hotel room, you know. I don't know if anybody else can identify with that. And I woke up in a cold sweat, and I was dreaming about Debbie, who, you know, Dick's wife, who died. And it was horrible. And I woke up, and I was talking to a friend about that tonight. And, you know, the voice of my old sponsor, one of my sponsors, came into my mind. He said, "That's your higher power telling you you're an addict," you know. And that kind of, the sense of, that feeling of fear went away about that. It was still there about coming here tonight, but that's something else. But, you know, I'm going to finish off now. I did make some notes, and I noticed I haven't referred to any of them. this is a very simple program. You know, it's a complex illness, and it's very simple. I believe, you know, if I continue to go to meetings, keep NA as my central point. You know, I can do anything else. You know, I'll say to people, if you want to chant Hare Krishna and run around Hyde Park stark naked and it keeps you clean, great. But go to NA first. You know, go to NA and keep NA as the central point. And that's what I've done. I've been clean 24 years now, and I've kept going to meetings. I've tried to work a program, and it's about balance. My whole recovery has been extreme. As I said, I've had like a million sponsees, you know, a million commitments, you know, loads of stuff going on. I'm a workaholic, you know, I'm still sort of quite proud. I can work 16 hours a day. It's not good. But I'm getting better. And it's a fourfold illness, you know. And I'm working on the spiritual part, but you have to work on it all. I work on the physical part, you know, I eat well. I don't believe you'll be a spiritual guru going to McDonald's. I'm sorry. But, you know, I change my socks every day. I change my underwear every day. And people say, "Yeah." Well, that's really important, you know. That's, all those things are really important. I'm trying to deal with it on an emotional basis, you know. Trying to talk about my feelings, which I can never talk about. Today I can talk about my feelings. I cried the other night listening to Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah. And I felt the tears in my eyes at the inauguration of Barack Obama. And that's fucking amazing. That is a miracle for me. Because I never could cry. I never cried when I used. Never. And I can cry today, not that freely, but I can, you know. But I'm gonna finish off there, and I'm just really grateful to have the privilege to share. And if anybody's new around, all I can say, just keep coming back. I know it probably doesn't make sense, but, you know, because it didn't make sense to me, I just kept coming back, even when I felt resistant and thought, "Fuck this," because it's like, it's like a love affair. You know, when you meet someone, you get into a relationship, it's all great initially, you know, and then it wears off. And that's, Scott Peck would say, that's where the hard work starts, you know. Because, to quote the first page of The Road Less Travelled, and this is, you know, the journey, the truth is life is difficult, and once you accept life, difficult becomes easier. And that's it. It's about acceptance. I'll leave there. Thank you.